Welcome back to Canna Week, brought to you by New Frontier Data, where we deliver the week's top headlines in cannabis and hear experts weigh in on the impact these stories are having on the industry. I'm your host, Heather Wickline. Before we get started, if you are loving this podcast, please be sure to like, subscribe, and leave us a five-star review. All right, so today we're going to be chatting about what's going on in California and taxation. So our guest today is a California native. He is a serial entrepreneur and currently serves as co-founder and president of Glasshouse Brands. Please welcome Graham Farrar.
Thanks a lot, Heather. I appreciate you guys having me.
Welcome, welcome. And as always, I'm always happy to welcome back our in-house expert, Mr. John Caguia. He serves as our chief knowledge officer at New Frontier Data.
Delighted to be back, Heather. Thank you for having me.
Of course. So, Graham, you have become this giant in California cannabis industry. I've even seen headlines that read from tech geek to Santa Barbara cannabis king. So tell us a little bit of the history of that, because I don't see a lot of people that are tech geeks and starting these businesses and coming into California as growers.
Yeah, so I think they're probably giving me more credit than I deserve there. The history is I'm a tech guy by kind of work experience, but I've always been a cannabis lover by passion. My first experience with cannabis is probably earlier than I should admit to. My first grow was back in college in Boulder. This was probably 1996 or something like that before they legalized. It was a small little closet grow, 2 foot by 3 foot. It's an ebb and flood system that I built myself. Funnily, interesting or ironically enough, at our new farm, we have our nursery is built on the same principle of ebb and flood. It just happens to be 100,000 times bigger than the first grow. From there, I went to, a room in a house, to a garage, to a house, to a couple of houses. And then about 7 years ago, started Glasshouse Farms with our first greenhouse. It was 150,000 square feet. At the time, we thought it was the biggest thing ever, and in many ways it was. And then a couple of years later, they bought a second greenhouse, which is 350,000 square feet. Thought that was the biggest thing ever. Then we opened our first store, The Pharmacy, which is the first ever adult use dispensary in the city of Santa Barbara. Amazing store, really a phenomenal, breaks down stigmas. It's what you think, it's what cannabis, I think retail feels like it should be. Then we went public. And the reason we did that was we took all the pieces that we built and kind of put them together and raised some money. And the reason for that was because we felt like we'd identify a kind of a unicorn farm. It's the second largest greenhouse in the United States. It's in a beautiful climate. I'm not sure there's a better one for growing cannabis, kind of 72 and sunny Southern California, a couple miles from the coast in Camarillo. It's a 125 acre farm. That's 5.5 million square feet. So we're not bringing on 5.5 million square feet today. 4 million of that is still growing fruits and vegetables, but 1.5 million square feet we have converted to cannabis. And think that we're going to be able to grow, some of the highest quality at scale with a very efficient and affordable cost structure. So that's we recently, just brought that online about 4 months ago, and it's got, a ton of really amazing things. Put that together with our retail and our brands. Glasshouse Farms has been a top flower brand in the state for going on 2 years now. We recently acquired Plus Gummies, which is a top edible brand. We've got started the year with 3 stores. Now we've got 6. We'll have 12 by the end of the year. And so basically just putting all that together in the, kind of a vertical integration of California cannabis.
So you're saying you haven't been really busy?
I'm not sure the last time I did sleep, but cannabis is, I think it's one of the best industries, right? I mean, it's this amazing, almost once in a life, time kind of opportunity to make the world a better place, because we think cannabis does, and we think ending the prohibition on cannabis does, and we think ending the war on drugs makes the world a better place. So you're doing something that I think makes society better. We're also, creating products and that consumers love, and we're giving hopefully a great home for our employees to work at, and creating, a valuable company and a, new kind of legal industry all at the same time. So it's, usually you can only get to pick a couple of those things, right? And in this case, you get to pick them all. On the other hand, it's also, I think, one of the hardest industries, certainly that I've ever worked in. And if you don't have a real passion for this, it will sort you out quick. So it is a ton of work, but we are really lucky to have the opportunity to work on the things that we're working on.
Amazing. So what were the people around you in your life's initial reaction when you were like, this tech giant, and saying, I'm going into cannabis?
Yeah, so I was growing on the side while working in tech for, I guess 10, 15 years. I was one of the original guys at software.com, which was early .com days company. We made email servers for telephone companies and ISPs. So basically we were the digital post office when normal people started getting email accounts. And on the side, I was growing in a house. And then I was one of the original guys at Sonos. And at that point, the home audio system, and at that point, I think we were growing in a couple of houses. And then I started a company that actually made fertilizer for cannabis, and realized that we were going to the best growers, because the kind of the thesis of it was the larger growers are going to happen. Large growers don't go to HydroStars and use, things off the shelf. They buy from ag supply companies. And one of the things that we found was that we were teaching them how to grow, and they were the best growers, and they didn't know enough about cannabis. And so why were we not just doing it? And that's kind of how the idea around Glasshouse Farms came to be, and how we started doing it ourselves at scale.
Amazing. John, any burning questions for Graham?
Well, just one. I mean, we've been watching Glasshouse for a while now. Phenomenal brand. We've been to pharmacy in Oakland, and unbelievable retail experience. There's so much kind of tension in the California market, both in terms of scale of opportunity, but also some of the hurdles we're going to be talking about here. I'm curious, as you look ahead, how do you think about your growth strategy? Is it, California now and for the foreseeable future, or are you already thinking about kind of national expansion, potentially international expansion, given the scale that you've already brought on?
So, I think one of our fundamental theses is that you should grow plants where plants like to grow. And mm-hmm. California is dominant. I mean, California is the fifth largest economy in the world. It's the largest cannabis market on the planet. It's, as big as the next two markets combined. It's almost as big as the next three, combined. So as a single place to be, it is the world's biggest market. I think, we will probably see unlikely that you will see us go grow in other places. But what I do think is going to happen is I think interstate commerce will come. I think federal legalization will come. We're not trying to bet on the date or, guess when exactly. But we do think it'll happen. And what we think that's going to mean is, just like 95% of wine comes from California, just like you probably don't have a favorite non-Mexican tequila brand, champagne comes from France. For most people, cannabis comes from California. And our belief is that 8 out of 10 brands will be California brands. So the national expansion will be grow cannabis in California, where the climate is beautiful for it, and ship those products across the country to be on the shelves of all the other, stores out there. So you may see that preceded by licensing deals, like Plus Gummies would be a great thing to license. We can teach somebody how to make that. But at the end of the day, I think the national expansion is grow cannabis in the 72 and sunny, beautiful California climate, and then ship the product that people want. And you can tell that they do, right? Like if you go to New York, there's unlicensed dispensaries everywhere. You ask them what they think about California cannabis. I did it firsthand, so I can tell you the answer is California cannabis is the best. It's all we sell, right? So when they don't have to follow the rules, that's what. Florida's a lot closer. They're not importing from Florida. They're coming from California. So eventually that'll happen legally, I think. And we'll be growing in California to help support the rest of the country.
That makes sense.
Yeah. How do you stand the 72 and sunny every day? I mean, geez.
It's tough, but someone has to endure.
Okay. Well, moving on. Political reports, tax cuts leave California pot businesses wanting much more. So since recreational cannabis was legalized in California in 2016, operators have really struggled to cope with complex regulations, onerous taxes, and off-the-books competition from unlicensed dispensaries. So while Newsom's call for an overhaul of the state's pot taxes garnered some attention, for many, the final costs have really fallen short of expectations. So Graham, how would you describe the current state of the legal cannabis industry in California?
Yeah, so it's California's interesting. It's a dichotomy, right? Which is, on the one hand, I think the most exciting market in the country, and a market that we know works, right? Like we have 26 years of Prop 215 medical cannabis. The farmers were pretty happy, the retailers were pretty happy, the consumers were pretty happy. And then Prop 64 came in, which is intended to be progress, right? Like, and I think it is from the point of view that you need to get to normal business, right? Legalization doesn't mean there's no rules. It means it's the rules that any other business would follow. Unfortunately, what we got with cannabis is most regulations of any business and the highest taxes of any business. So we took what was actually working pretty well and we broke it with taxes and regulations. Good news is we know that means that we can fix it, right? Like the consumer is still there. There's more consumers than there ever have been in the past. There'll be more consumers tomorrow than today. So like the potential is all there. But paying 50% taxes, having 60% of the state not allow legal cannabis dispensaries, regulations that make the cost so much higher, it doesn't work, right? And so the cultivation tax going away, I think was this. There's two things we need in California: less taxes, more retail. That's it. So the cultivation tax going away was a great step, but it needs to be the first step, not the last step. It was an extremely onerous tax. It was collected at a early in the supply chain. It was weight based. So as prices have compressed, the tax rate went up. It was $161 a pound. When cannabis is $1,000 a pound, it's a 16% tax. $500 a pound is a 32% tax, right? If you're an outdoor grower selling for $300 a pound, it's a 50-something percent tax, right? So like that is a horrible tax. So that going away is big, makes us more competitive, brings us closer to, you know, the cost of unlicensed cannabis. It helps the consumer, it drives volume. It's a, you know, big meaty paw out, but there is still local municipal taxes. There's still the excise tax, which can be upwards of 20 something percent. There's still municipal taxes on retail. There's sales tax, there's mandated distribution. So, you know, I think the next thing we need to talk about is, and they did it in the end of alcohol prohibition, right? So there's a model. Come follow the rules, right? That was the pitch, right? Like, come join the legal system. But then you can make it easy, not 10 times harder, right? And so what they did with alcohol prohibition, I think it was a 7-year tax holiday. So come join the legal side, follow the rules. You don't know taxes for 7 years. We need to get something like that in place for California cannabis, because at the end of the day, I think we all want the industry to survive. We want, you know, people voted for more access to cannabis. They currently have less. So the other side of that is, you know, people talk about over demand. I tend to talk about undersupply because we have 1,000 dispensaries in California. We have 11,000 liquor stores, right? Like that's not the right ratio. Colorado, Oregon, Washington, all pretty similar. It's about a dispensary for every 5,000 people. California has one for every 40,000 people. It doesn't. It actually has one legal one and then probably, you know, four more unlicensed ones, but that can't be the client of a licensed producer. So if we had five times as many legal stores, I think we'd talk a lot less about oversupply. I think everybody'd be happier. So less taxes, more retail. I think California will eventually get back to its thriving position. We just need to fix those things.
Well, John, you've been watching the California market. Anything to add to that?
Yeah, I think this retail access issue is really, really critical. You know, local autonomy, the idea that both cities and counties would have the ability to decide what types of cannabis businesses to permit was critical to being able to get the law passed at the state level. But it's created a level of asymmetry that we really haven't seen in any other legal market. And this is particularly critical because of the scale of the production side in California. So as Graham said, there's 8,000 operators have been licensed to grow, only 1,000 for retail. Compare that to Colorado, where it's a one-to-one ratio. There's about 1,000, a little over 1,000 producers to about 1,000 retailers. Two, because of 60% of the municipalities having some level of prohibition against retail businesses, I was just doing this analysis this morning, 46% of Californians are living in a jurisdiction in a city which does not have retail access. You know, that's a huge challenge to overcome, or that's a huge issue to overcome, and it creates a really broad tunnel which the unregulated market can cement itself, making it really challenging for the retail operators to make inroads into this. There's some discussion now about trying to create a statewide, at least delivery-based model so that you can get delivery even in places where storefronts might not be permitted. But until this retail nut is cracked, I think there's going to continue to be a challenge to how quickly this market can scale. This is not a lack of consumers. This is not an issue of consumers not being interested in the product, and the product quality in the legal market has just gone through the roof. I think that's been part of the reason why Glasshouse has seen so much success. It's just not available in enough places to one absorb all of the capacity being produced by the thousands of producers that are going to be coming online. And two, certainly not enough reach to be able to serve the huge consumer demand there, even as consumers increasingly, even as the downward price pressure offsets this high tax that the legislature has put on the final product.
Yeah, no, I think that's it's totally true. I mean, we have seen some good news there, or progress, I should say. In the last 2 weeks of June, we saw something like an 8% increase in the total number of retail licenses issued by the state of California, right? So in 2 weeks in June, we upped it by 8% over what's been accomplished in 4 years of Prop 64. And that 2 weeks was bigger than the month of May, and May was bigger than Q4 of last year, right? So the slope of the line is going up, but you know, the two-tier, the municipal approval was key, as John said, to getting it passed. It's also, I think, the original sin of the California market, which is we didn't actually legalize in California. We just said it was okay for municipalities to legalize. And that's tough, regardless of if people want it. The process is tough, right? Like, yeah. I mean, Fresno, for example, wants it. They just issued 15 licenses, I think, for 500,000 people. But up until 2 weeks ago, there's a 500,000 people, that's the size of Rhode Island, that had to drive an hour to find a legal dispensary, right? That is the opposite of what people voted for. They wanted more access. They currently still have less. And so, I mean, we will make that progress. I don't know of a speakeasy. I don't know of a place to buy bathtub gin. I don't know of a place to buy gas for half price with no tax in it, right? Like eventually, like that, we will have access to legal cannabis and it will take it over. And I think it is real demand, right? And that's the key thing, is the oversupply to me is always from the consumer's point of view. That's when someone's throwing weed in the Pacific Ocean because no one wants it. I have never heard a consumer say, I have more cannabis than I want. It's better than I want. It's cheaper than I want, right? Like when that happens, that's a saturated, oversupplied market. This is not this. This is access and regulations and taxes restricting the market to the point that it's having a hard time working. So people want more cannabis, right? And there's more people who want it each day. And that's the long-term trend.
Well, you've both touched on these unlicensed businesses. So Graham, how do you think legal operators can compete with these? Like besides tax relief, what do legal operators need to do to thrive?
Yeah, I mean, I think really all they need is a level playing field, right? Like if you have to, you know, we have a massive amount of compliance costs, license costs, tax costs, regulatory costs, track and trace costs, right? Like somehow that has to get, that's getting absorbed. Someone who doesn't have a license doesn't have to do any of that, right? Now, you know, and so I think a level playing field is enough there. We should not be putting people in jail, right? So like, I think we're past, that was a bad idea the first time. It's certainly not something that we need to keep doing. So, you know, enforcement is not the solution. The solution is, in my opinion, open up the right channel, right? Like no one wants the political will to go back to the retail, you know, conversation, the political will to shut down an unlicensed store when it's the only store is basically zero. People wanted more access. Now you're going to say close down the only option. That doesn't make any sense, right? It changes though, when you open the licensed store, now you have someone not following the rules, someone who is trying to follow the rules. That person following the rules is also generating tax revenue. So then you have, you know, the impetus, the kind of the will to say, hey, well, like, that's not fair. You can't come play soccer and pick the ball up with your hands. Like that's not the game. Right. And so I think as that wheel turns, it'll kind of get its own momentum. I mean, people have talked about civil penalties and, you know, should a landlord be able to get double market rent by renting to an unlicensed dispensary? I don't know, probably not following the rules shouldn't make you more money. But, you know, I think the real thing is just give the licensed operators, most people, like, they don't want bathtub gin. They're just, if it's twice as much to get the legal stuff, it makes it hard. If it's 20% more, I think a lot of people are interested in that. You know, you get edibles, you get drinks, you get all things, kinds of things that are, you know, only really available in licensed shops. And if you fix the retail demand, I think the rest of the market sorts itself out pretty well.
John, what do you say to that?
I think there's another dimension here that is unique to California that has to be kind of considered as part of this, which is what it is doing to this very large group of operators, of growers who've been operating this market for a really long time. They're not operating at a large scale. You know, it's the small scale operators up in Northern California who don't produce a great ton. Like, these people aren't building empires, but they have been part of this culture of innovation around cannabis in California for years, if not decades. And they have really struggled through this process. They're not deeply capitalized. They haven't had a ton of money. The regulations have been really, really costly to navigate. Some of them have not been able to sell because they're in limbo waiting for approvals. And it means that for people who live on the cash that they're making, it's forced a lot of them into this really tense position of, yes, I want to transition to the legal market, but if it's going to take me 2 years to get permitted and I'm not able to make any income in that time because I'm going to be under a microscope, you know, what recourse do I have but to pull my hat out of the myself out of the legal market and stay in the unregulated one? Or worse still, particularly if the state starts adopting an aggressive enforcement approach, it pushes them out of the market entirely. So you start having this kind of loss of knowledge from people who have been doing this very successfully and are part of the lifeblood of innovation in California's cannabis economy. I think it would be really tragic if, as an outcome of this transition from California's medical to the adult use market, because of this very drawn out process of trying to get the regulations out, you lost some of these, what I call the basement tinkerers, the people who aren't operating at a large scale, but are doing some really compelling work. Because I think they are part of what adds to the cultural differentiation of California's cannabis market. The product may not be available in every dispensary in the state, but it adds to the idea that, you know, California does not become a state where kind of only the big brands can play and the only products you can find are from the large manufacturers, but where you have a rich diversity of products being produced by every manner of grower, and all of those growers are able to make a successful living at it. The market opportunity is there. Unfortunately, the market structure just doesn't permit it. And talking to folks in Humboldt and Mendocino and in Trinity, they're really struggling up there because of the tension of these regulations. And it would be a pity if the state isn't able to find a way to do this quickly enough that these folks are able to fully transition and successfully transition to the legal side and become effective participants in this market.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we need to end the war on drugs, right? Not perpetuate it, right? Congratulations, drugs. They won the war. Like, we need to drop that, leave it alone. We all know it was bullshit. We know it wasn't really a war on drugs. It was war on some drugs and some people. And it was very successful, right? But now that's the end of that, right? So you cannot, the state already tried to arrest their way out of this. It did not work. It hasn't worked anywhere. It hasn't worked with anything. Anytime you try and prohibit a mutually beneficial transaction for people, you're doomed to failure, right? Like, the fact is, people want to grow cannabis. People want to consume cannabis. You're not going to stop that from happening because both sides are happy about it, right? And so the challenge is, you cannot use a stick. You know, we need a carrot. And one of the things that's the most frustrating for me on the federal side is, we know that the world wants California cannabis. The legacy guys that got us here up in NorCal, the small growers that, you know, literally fought a war and helped build this, right? Like, people, they should be selling eights for $80 direct to consumer, just like Sea Smoke sells their wine, and their 10,000 square foot farm turned into eights and bought by people who want it is a fine and great living, right? And, you know, I think cannabis is far better than alcohol, but I use it as an example, right? Which is Russian, one of my favorite beers is Pliny the Elder, Russian River Brewing in Santa Rosa. Mm-hmm. You basically got to go to the brewery to get it, right? Yeah. It is a very different thing. I love it with a steak or dinner, but I don't want a six pack of it at the beach, right? Like, I'd much rather have a Pacifico for that. It is awesome for somebody up in the Emerald Triangle to be Russian River and produce a Pliny and sell it, and it's, you know, $10 a beer and they're making it by hand. It's also great for me to be Pacifico and have, you know, cannabis that you can get everywhere. Neither one of those things is wrong, right? There's a place for all that. Unfortunately, regulations, both state and federal, are stopping what farmers want to grow, stores want to sell, consumers want to consume, right? And regulations is holding that back. And it's, you know, to John's point, it's hard to watch what's happening because, but for the timing, there are people doing things that should be successful, and whether it's, you know, Mendocino having a 10,000 square foot cap on the size so that they can't achieve scale, whether it's the time it takes to get a license. Like, I don't know how the regulators expect it to be successful. And it's, you know, it's hard to watch when, you know, it's going to work. It just needs to work quicker.
Yeah.
Well, turning towards the national policy, SAFE Banking recently passed again. And Schumer's
seventh time, I think.
What?
I think it was the seventh time.
Yeah. Again. And Schumer's CIOA was introduced in the Senate. How optimistic are you that federal cannabis legislation can gain traction this time?
Yeah. So actually, with CIOA, it's the first time, and that's that's unique, right? So I think it is a sign of progress. It is the first ever Senate bill that's on cannabis. There's a couple other signs of progress, right? Which I think there's a decent chance that a veterans cannabis research bill will actually make it to the Oval Office. That would be another first. I don't think Senator Schumer's bill is going anywhere itself, but I think it is, you know, knocking bricks out of the wall, so to speak, of moving the conversation forward. I think there is a decent odds that SAFE and maybe even a SAFE Plus. If I was going to be predicting things, I think there's a chance that there's SAFE Banking combined with the HOPE Act, which is Dave Joyce is one of the sponsors of that. I think that's a good thing. It's federal funds to states to help with expungements and clearing cannabis convictions. So that's an important thing. One of the great things about legalization is that it should remove things that we've now, as a society, said shouldn't be a stain on someone's record. The challenge is not, you know, even California, I think they went back to 2011 or something like that. But you have to do the work as the person who is wrongly, you know, convicted, right, to clear it in a lot of cases. And so funding for that is a big deal. And then there's a veterans access bill. And, you know, the initial research on PTSD and the way the cannabis can help vets is significant. So I think there is a chance that you get some, you know, industry banking, which is also social equity, because the people who need bank accounts are the ones who can't get them. We have a bank account already, right? It's the folks who are trying to open a social equity license or a smaller business. Those are the ones that the SAFE will really help the most, I think, if you have that. So some industry, some social equity, you got social justice from the HOPE Act, and you get some research and access for the veterans. I think that is a package that, even with our political system, you should be able to find the votes to make happen. I mean, 9 out of 10 people in the country want cannabis to be legalized in some form. We should be able to find 60 senators who agree.
Right. My apologies. We've talked about the draft of the CIOA at nauseam.
I mean, it's been a long time coming. I feel like I've been waiting for that thing forever. But, you know, I think what it does do is it clears the way for the conversation. And I, from the language I hear, you know, whether it's Cory Booker at the hearing yesterday, seemed to be saying that he thought, you know, we need to get something done. You know, that should change from I'm laying my body down to stop incrementalism, which is where I started. I think Schumer said something like, you know, let's discuss what we can get done this year. So I think that, I think now that that's out, that's the you know, his panacea. I think we have a conversation about what progress we can make. You know, good news too is, you know, we have the States Reform Act from Nancy Mace. This is clearly not just a Democratic issue anymore. I think the Nancy Mace's bill, to me, makes a ton of sense. It's basically treat it like alcohol and let the states do what they want. We don't need to make this complicated, right? Like, I understand the call for social justice, but I also say we still have a drug war. First, stop digging, right? Like, stop arresting people for cannabis. Then you can also figure out what do you do to repair the damage that was already done. But I don't know that there's a reason you need to keep doing the damage while you figure out how to repair the damage that's done, right? Like, so I think we can make some progress here without trying to boil the ocean all at once.
John, anything to add to that? I know we've talked about this a million times, so.
Just that I think the timing is really interesting here. So to Graham's point, so the COA now is a really broad and expansive bill, which is unlikely to get full congressional approval, certainly full senatorial approval. But it then makes it much easier to pick off the pieces which people are going to be comfortable with. And particularly going into the midterms, into a cycle where we'll probably have at least a few additional states voting on medical use, potentially one or two on adult use. The conversation about finally addressing banking in this industry, the timing works well based on the fact that the market is likely to expand even further going into November. So COA, I think, sets the bar high enough that doing something smaller then becomes a lot more palatable, even for those who may not be too enthusiastic about this market. But we're certainly at the point now where, as a country, it's impossible to argue that given the size of this industry, that having such a significant proportion of this industry still unable to access conventional financial services and it's still paying such an extraordinary premium
right? Like, you know, it's like there's people getting shot on a regular basis at dispensaries because they can't use credit cards and put their money in banks. I mean, it's, you know, 20 states are adult use, 40 states if you include medical. Like, it's happening, yet we're sitting here in this, you know, political morass of not updating public policy to keep people safer with what they're already doing. It's a borderline travesty to watch what is easily preventable not be prevented.
Yeah.
Certainly, I think we've crossed the Rubicon from it being a question of if to it being when, and when becoming something that's going to be happening here in the relatively short term.
I think the odds of putting this genie back in the bottle are zero, right? I mean, we know where it's going. It seems like we should make it as good as we can in each individual moment.
I couldn't agree more. Well, Graham, could you look into your crystal ball and tell me any predictions you have for the rest of 2022 or and beyond that?
What do I think? I mean, I think we will see, as we talked about, I think we will see something happen on the federal level. It'll be incremental, but I think it will be, you know, a clear indicator of the fact that this truly is going to end up, you know, in making progress. I think it's going to continue to be a turbulent a year for California. I think that we're going to see the rest of the country look more and more like California over time in terms of competition, price compression. I think California kind of lives in the future, so to speak, you know, from the discerning customer to the size of, you know, the market and competition and, you know, brands and things like that. So I think that's going to be a trend in California will be, you know, kind of the leading indicator on that. But, you know, I do think overall, I think cannabis makes the world a better place. I think we're making progress towards that. It's slower and feels like it's a perpetual 3 years to do it, but I do think we're getting there. And I think you'll start to see cannabis take its rightful place more and more. For example, I just got back from the state fair last weekend in California, first ever state fair to include cannabis, right? Like, it's easy to dismiss that, but it's also, I think, important not to, because now, you know, it's probably the largest cash crop if you include licensed and unlicensed cannabis. For the first time ever, it's there next to the corn and the avocados and the kids' candy maze and the arts and crafts. And you had 100,000 people who are not, they weren't at a cannabis cup. They were coming to see what California was about, right? And California is about cannabis. And so to see that start to normalize, I think is key. More retail doors opens it up. I mean, it's a one-way transition. I only hear people who thought cannabis was bad, had some experience, realized that it's actually not, right? I don't hear, there is no the other direction right now. And so, you know, prohibition's on offer until we have all our rights, and our rights should be to demand that we get to at least have the same relationship with cannabis as we do with alcohol. And I think every day we get a little closer to it.
Yeah, I think that state fair is a big step. I mean, I know John spoke at a conference that was hosted at the UN in May, which I don't think they've ever hosted anything about cannabis. So that's, I mean, I think all these little tiny incremental steps of normalization is huge. John, any final thoughts from you?
Yeah, just kind of looking out at the end of the year, I think we're going to see two tensions. One is, you know, the economy looks like it's facing, we're going to a pretty challenging cycle. I think Q3, Q4, potentially Q1 next year could be a painful turn relative to the very, very bull bullish growth that we've seen over the past little while. And I think that's going to create two dynamics. One, it's going to put a lot of stress on companies that are inefficiently run in cannabis. I think this is going to be an opportunity to separate the companies that are built for the long term versus those who weren't able to get their operations prepared for this market. But two, we've also tended to see an increase in consumer demand for cannabis during difficult times. So I think on the one hand, we're actually likely to see an increase in consumer interest in cannabis. Their spending might come down, but overall, I think we're going to see continued strong growth in this side of the economy. Most of our data suggests that cannabis, if not recession-proof, is at least recession-resilient, very recession-resilient. But two, I think we're going to start seeing a bit of a culling of the herd in terms of some of these companies who built their companies for sunny times and perhaps may not have read the tea leaves well in terms of where the broader economy was going and didn't have the capital reserves, or didn't have the market penetration, didn't have the strong products or differentiated products that ensure that the consumers who are going to be in this market and very active looking for the right thing for them, that they'll be able to compete in that kind of environment. So it's going to be certainly a turbulent second half of this year on many dimensions. But I think the companies that are able to live through this coming storm will be very strongly positioned for the long term. And the long term outlook is very, very positive.
Agree with that.
I like it. Well, Graham, before we wrap, we give everyone, any of our guests, a chance to give a shout out to someone in the industry. So the floor is yours.
Yeah, I don't know if he's quite industry, but he deserves at least honorary membership, which is Weldon Angelos. He is someone that we've had the honor of working with. He has the Mission Green Project, which is working on getting nonviolent cannabis prisoners out of prison. He was convicted of selling $300 of cannabis or, you know, something in that neighborhood and essentially given a life sentence. Thankfully, he got clemency from Obama and a full pardon from Trump, but only after spending 13 years in prison. And he has made it his mission to get the other folks like Parker Coleman and many others out. He recently testified at the hearing yesterday, invited, I think, by Cory Booker himself on the legalization of cannabis. He was before that. He was just at a hearing in Washington with the clemency attorney. They submitting cases on people. I mean, there's people in prison, not for nonviolent cannabis, who can invest in our company's stock for doing what they're in prison for, right? Like the hypocrisy and the nonsensicalness of that is crazy, right? I mean, we drop more cannabis on the ground and each day probably then many of them are in jail for essentially life prison terms for. And so I think I would happily give up the progress on the business side to get those people out of prison. And Weldon's the man in the arena, so to speak, leading the charge on making that happen, and deserves a thanks and support from all of us for the work he's doing.
Thank you. That's amazing. Well, thank you both so much for your time. And thank you to our listeners for joining us at Canna Week. Please be sure to like and subscribe and share this episode. I'm your host, Heather Wickline, and we will see you next time.
New Frontier Data provides this podcast for entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated in this podcast should be taken as legal or financial advice. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by the company. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Views and opinions expressed by New Frontier Data employees are those of the employees and do not necessarily reflect the view of the company or any of its officials. If you have any questions about this disclaimer, please contact our legal department.